Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 79, section 7, which is old single column, page 886. Okay, we have this final chunk of this paper that focuses in, you know, very specifically and, you know, even geographically within what we currently call China, relative to Chinese civilization, basically. You know, we'll get a little bit more about you know, the Andites coming in to that area and giving the civilizational potential of Yellow Man a booster shot. But the main point now is to not talk so much about Andite migration directly as to talk about the evolution of Chinese civilization. Starting back, you know, around the beginning times of that major Andite migration, and rolling all the way to the present day. We saw that last week already. They were speaking of things that have immediate relevance to what's beginning to transpire amongst the Chinese people. As they shift out of the mode that they've basically been in for thousands and thousands of years of being, you know, in relative terms anyway, quite content to be quite passive, quite satisfied with their location and just chugging along there in the Far East. But that's beginning to change, and it's very important that the revelators lay out their history for us, get us to understand the dynamics of that people, because the emergency that the planet is in is going to intimately involve the Chinese people. They're a very major factor in what's going on. You know, they're not, you know, the source of the emergency. You know, don't misunderstand me in that regard. You know, it's the Andite spear point dropping the ball that's the source of the emergency. But you know, as they talked about it last time, this is a major mass of mankind. There are no solutions to the problems of mankind as a whole, ignoring such a major fraction of what's going on this planet. It's just, you know, they have to be an integral part of the global solution to the philosophic emergency. In just in a more generalized sense, inescapably, they will play a large part in either the collapse of civilization or in helping to take it forward into the quest for knowledge and wisdom and out of you know, the potential stumbling and falling process that's in play in the in the later stages of the material comfort era that we find ourselves in. Either way, you know, very, very significant fact on the planet, we need to understand what drives them, how they basically see themselves in the world that they live in. It began to be established very, very long time ago. you know, the way American people see themselves and the worldview that they work within is a very recent phenomenon. Not so with the Chinese. Right. They have a very different perspective on things than an American will ever have. And so that's, you know, that's the main point. Is remember, it's almost always about civilization, even if you aren't directly reading about civilization. You know, to appreciate just how much the Jesus papers are about civilization. I mean, if they're all about Jesus, that leads to Jesusism, for instance. Doesn't mean that they aren't about Jesus, but if they're all about Jesus, that's Jesusism. And so anyway, it's always the case as you're reading the fifth epical revelation to appreciate that how this speaks to the truth that we lack, the relationship to truth that we lack, the lack of the big picture that we find ourselves in the midst of. It's a complicated set of parts. So wrapping your mind around the big picture involves a lot of details. You have to think about paleontology, and you have to think about Chinese history, and you have to think about, you know, this, that, and the other thing, all kinds of different things to wrap your mind around the big picture. All right, so let's see what they do here is, like I said, is they sort of actually penetrate down into the details of China itself now.
Section 7, the Andites enter China. About 15,000 years ago, the Andites, in considerable numbers, were traversing the pass of Di Tao and spreading out over the upper valley of the Yellow River among the Chinese settlements of Gansu. Presently, they penetrated eastward to Honan, where the most progressive settlements were situated. This infiltration from the west was about half Andonite and half Andite.
Okay, so when we remember, they've mentioned that obviously in the very early times, you don't just have Andite. There's Andonites being moved about by all this migration as well. So they're reminding you that you're bringing a lot of Andonite in from Turkestan, as well as Andite, at least in the early stages. The later stages, you're just putting kind of more and more Andite cream on top. But it, you know, the main thing that you see immediately is like, whoa, all these place names and stuff, okay? So let's get ourselves situated. What are they, what's the point of mentioning these names that they just did? So remember that you have the Andites in the Tarim Basin in Xinjiang, you know, the great big country that's called China today, right? Xinjiang is that most northwestern province of China. So we have Andites there, and we're wanting to get those Andites into China proper, right? Get them to the heart of China, where historical Chinese records, you know, speak of the foundation of Chinese civilization. Okay, and where that most definitively is in that province called Hunan. There. Okay, that's the. You know, the great central region there, the very populous central region that is, you know, where the Chinese see their civilization being founded. Okay? But there's a lot of territory between all the way into the middle of Hunan province and, you know, clear off there in the northwestern corner, you know, of the Tarim Basin. Okay, and so the first thing that you're having to do is get out of that basin through a pass heading east, Right, so that Didao Pass there, okay, just heading east out of the basin, you know, sort of straight east, and getting into that first province, Gansu, that's spanning those, as they're saying, the upper valley of the Yellow River, the upper regions of the Yellow River. Okay, you know, which, you know, is flowing towards the Pacific Ocean, right? So, all right, so that's what they're, you know, they're just, you know, immediately going to the east into Gansu, following the Yellow River down, and at this point they're skipping over some of the intermediate details, but eventually getting all the way into the heart of northern China there, of Honan. All right, is there anything else there? I think we've got, yeah. Okay, let's, is there any confusion about that? Anything I need to clear up with that? All right, let's get a little bit more.
The northern centers of culture along the Yellow River had always been more progressive than the southern settlements on the Yangtze. Within a few thousand years after the arrival of even the small numbers of these superior mortals, the settlements along the Yellow River had forged ahead of the Yangtze villages and had achieved an advanced position over their brethren in the south, which has ever since been maintained.
Okay, so this whole bit of, see, the seat of Chinese civilization, you know, from their historical records, they think of that beginning there in Honan, you know, say in the second millennium BC. Rebels are saying, no, that was set up long, long before the second millennium BC. Even before you began to definitively boost the Yellow River culture ahead of the Yangtze River culture. And, as they point out, see, the northern centers of culture along the Yellow River had always been more progressive. Okay, because as we remember what we've read, you know, even apart from Adamic blood getting in there, you have a genetic differential between north and south. With, you know, more red-yellow combination, you know, boosting things in the north, but yellow secondary Sangic lessening things in the south. Okay. So we're just going to take that differential and accentuate it. And so at a very, you know, many, many, many thousands of years ago, you had the founding of Chinese civilization, pre-written, you know, record civilization, but nonetheless, the founding of you know, the seat of Chinese civilization there in Honan province. Okay, that's the sort of radical thing that's between the lines there, is just how far back that goes, you know, unbeknownst to current scientists, current archaeologists. You know, notice they even use some, you know, pretty leaning forward words like advanced position. Right? So, you know, they're, even if that advanced nature hasn't fully actualized yet, if you speak about the potential and the actual, right, it has great potential because of all of this sort of catalyzing and priming of the Sangic evolutionary nature by the Sandite injection. All right, let's see. Yeah, and I think I mentioned it last time. It helps us to keep in mind one of the most basic facts about the way the Chinese think. In just going through this history, you know, and reading sentences like "within a few thousand years," right? To just let that sink in, right? That you're thinking about a gestation, you know, that has thousands of years, you know, not just a few hundred, like American civilization. And so that it just innately has embedded in it, you know, no matter how much this is beyond what they think their history is, you know, they think their history is 3,000 years, say, okay, just because it's thousands of years more than that, they don't have to know about it. It just sort of sees innate in them that it's this very methodical process that's been building up over thousands of years. It, you know, it didn't leap out of the blocks. You know, it's not one of those conversion sort of suddenlies. It's like the faith of Jesus. It's a pure gradually, right? No Paul-like conversion moment, right? It's just this very gentle over many thousand years. So see, and if you think about it like that, it's an ominous sort of, see, momentum that's building, right? Ever so slowly, kind of unnoticeable in any, you know, over any century, say. But as you step back and look at it in the span of thousands of years, right, it's rolling and it's picking up steam and it has great mass. It takes a long time to get that big of a mass rolling, but once it's rolling, okay, so that's you know, that's the basic essence of what they're trying to get you to appreciate by stepping through this history, so that you don't think of them, you know, through projection. Oh well, they're, you know, they're just like us. You know, they're this kind of recent phenomenon. You know, that burst out of nowhere. No, right? They're not like that at all. In many ways, they're. You know, even if you follow Western civilization from here back through, you know, Northern Europe to Rome to Greece, you still don't have something that has this inexorable buildup like Chinese civilization does, right? In Western, it kind of, you know, is more bouncy. It spurts out and then fades and spurts, and, you know. There's just this very continuous rolling phenomenon. Okay. All right.
It kind of suggests a lot of potency here with the comment, even with the small numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Burst, you know, got them stimulated a big way.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to. Kind of bring that up again in the next paragraph, you know, to talk about that a little bit more. That, you know, we mentioned that last week. I mean, we don't have anywhere near the numbers of Andites coming into China like we did into Europe. And if we had, okay, if there had been a fifth epical revelation, it probably would have come to China, right, instead of the United States. The world would have been completely different. They would have been dominant long ago on the planet if they'd gotten that kind of andite. But as they'll explain here in a second, see, it's enough that, you know, especially when you have pretty much just pure primary Sangic stock that it's being blended into, that you know, it a little goes a long ways. Okay, so let's see what they say a little bit more about that, you know, that degree of andite infusion.
It was not that there were so many of the andites, nor that their culture was so superior, but amalgamation with them produced a more versatile stock. The northern Chinese received just enough of the andite strain to mildly stimulate their innately able minds, but not enough to fire them with the restless, exploratory curiosity so characteristic of the northern white races. This more limited infusion of Andite inheritance was less disturbing to the innate stability of the Sangic type.
See, so how they're describing it, you know, I've been kind of speaking in those terms, you know, the whole time so far, that they don't, it's like the tortoise and the hare story. See, you can see it right there. Right? They don't leap off the blocks like the hare. They didn't get that kind of Andite infusion. So they're like the tortoise. That Andite just is just enough to prime the pump and get it moving. And in many ways, it's kind of appropriate. If you're going to get that big of a mass, eventually all moving in one vast, direction, you know, it has to be this just slow building up, step by step. And that's, so it's actually kind of interesting, see, that it ended up that way. Maybe when all is said and done, that's the best way to get Yellow Man's civilization moving, you know, is to not put a whole bunch of Andite in there so they go flying off in every direction, you know, like Norsemen, you know, flying off in every direction, you know, half of them dying in glorious battles, you know, here, there, and everywhere, and being short-circuited from history, you know, or whatnot. You know, they all stay put, and they're basically safe, and they just get moving, not with their feet so much, but in their minds. Right? This rolling process, see, over all these millennia, see, is basically in their minds, and now it's to the point where it's actually beginning to manifest in their feet. That's what's just beginning to happen now, is all of that motion that's built up in the mind is about to manifest materially.
Refresh my memory, what adjutant they're connected with?
The one they favor is the fifth adjutant. So they lead with that social urge. Right? Their first instinct is to try to figure out a way to coordinate the differences and get everyone doing something as a group. Yeah. And if it takes a while to do that, okay, they'll take that time. You know, whereas opposed, someone has more Andite infusions, like, oh, we don't have time for that whole long complicated process. You know, we've got to go. Seize the moment, right? You know, just a very different mentality that they take. Between that thinking in long time spans and thinking in a very natural collective way, that should give you everything you need to go, that's going to be something to be reckoned with, okay? Right? That isn't something that's going to be easily divided and conquered. Right? They've made sure that they're kind of undividable. You know, they've taken the time to super glue themselves together first, right? Right? And then they're going to roll in one giant mass.
They had to have it already in their minds to do it in that
world. Yeah, and just how much... That's just what they do naturally. They don't even have to be aware, self-aware, right, in this regard. That's just how they roll naturally. Okay? Now, the more that they get a more personal nature manifesting and start to become self-aware of their nature, well, okay, there's, ooh. we could add to that naturalness with our unnaturalness in kind. And be all the more unstoppable, okay, and indivisible. All right. Let's see. So, you see how they're obviously, you know, between the lines taking a little jab at what happened in Europe, but not enough to fire them with a restless exploratory curiosity so characteristic of the Northern White races. Well, okay, that's a double-edged sword, and we all know, like I was saying. I mean, sure, on the one hand, that's great, but... it's fired up so much that you get more of a personal nature. Personality is absolutely unique. It's going to be much greater tendency for there to be individualism than collectivism, right? And everyone to break up. It's like, I want to go that way. Well, okay, well, you go that way and I'll go that way, you know? And everyone just goes off in every which direction, you know? And then the mass just slides over and slips into the spot that's been vacated by those that went off randomly in every direction. It's a very simple thing if you take a long-term view and a collective, solid collective view. You can just wait for the rabbits to go shooting off in every direction, and then you can just slide into place. Yeah. All right. When they say it was less disturbing to the innate stability of the Sangic type, that's where you can see very directly the revelators speaking in terms of the first six adjutants are fundamentally place-like. The seventh is direction-like. And that's the first, if you come, you know, imagine mind coming down undifferentiated into seven phases, but coming down as a single phase and understanding how it ends up as seven. The first thing that you should picture it splitting into two phases, a direction phase and a place phase. Okay, and that direction phase goes all the way down to the bottom as the seventh adjutant. Okay, the place phase, as it continues down, is going to split some more. Right? It's going to split. That place like is then going to split into a phase that is in the moment, then a phase that's long term. Okay, and then it keeps going down, and then each of those splits into three phases for individuality, associativity, unity. Right, the in-the-moment ones are the first three adjutants. The long-term ones are the second three adjutants. Okay. And there's a little parallel thing, even, you know, if you go up even higher than where I started, you go up higher and you can think of as having spirit and mind together, if you will, having what we call the Holy Spirit being the most spiritualized part of mind above the local universe level, but it's all together as one. You drop it down into the local universe and you split off that very unity-like aspect of it as the Holy Spirit, and then you have mind, right, to the side of it, and then, you know, follow that mind down like I just did and split it into seven phases. So that Holy Spirit comes all the way down through that process that we just stepped through, you know, and after the first step of getting place and direction separated, the seventh adjutant, he followed the Holy Spirit the rest of the way down parallel to it. So that's, you know, that's how you end up with those eight facts down at the bottom that engage you and make you a human. Right, that cosmic mind split into eight phases, if you will. Right? I'm playing with it a little bit, you know, because literally the Holy Spirit is a spirit energy ministry. Okay, it isn't literally mind energy, but I hope you get the point, right? I mean, it's just when you think about what the Holy Spirit does to your adjutant mind, it produces this spiritualized mind. that we put in the upper domain of the hourglass analogy. You know, and then those seven phases are down in the lower domain, or six down in the lower and one in the neck, okay, if you will, right, the seventh in the neck. But see, all of that, that spiritualized mind and the seventh adjutant and the six adjutants and that whole hourglass analogy, right, you bottle all of that up into, you know, one phase of mind up at the super universe level. And so, anyway, it's all, you know, off on a tangent, but it's a great opportunity. So just to recognize, you know, that you've got these six place-like adjutants. So there's going to be six sanghics, right? One favoring each of the six. One getting the place established in a six, in each of the sixfold ways. You know, one sanghic establishing each of the different modes of place-likeness. And then the Adam and Eve coming to the world and directionizing all of that, giving an upstep so that, of their kind of mindedness that has a bias to the seventh adjutant first and the other six subsequent. So that, because that, eventually the seventh adjutant has to lead because it has to bring symmetry, proportion, and balance to the other six. You know, it needs to be, in the hourglass analogy, it needs to be above them, overseeing them, right, from the third level down. Okay, so, you're taking that potential of that place likeness of the six adjutants, you know, made flesh with six different sanghic races, and bringing it all together, harmonizing it, and directionizing it with the seventh, with the biologic uplift. Okay, so anyway, back to the yellow man. He's always, by nature, leading with his fifth, and so before he tries to follow the natural functioning of the third, say, he's going to see to it that he's dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's relative to the fifth first. Right? Like, sure, I want to, you know, be loyal, but I need to first make sure I have a solid socialization in place. And then I'll deal with loyalty and, you know, and whatnot. He just leads with that. Red man, shoot first, ask questions later. He's leading with zeal, right? So, you know, he doesn't think, well, you know, I should try to figure out how to socialize these tensions between the tribes. No, I think I'm just going to kill the other tribe, right? That's his first instinct, right? And so internecine warfare, right? You know, it was just totally destroying them because they're leading with that zeal. Rather than, well, you know, we should try to get over that difference, find a way to socialize it. Can we come up with some elaborate moray system that allows for all the differences under some big umbrella? See, that's what the Chinese did, you know. It took them a long time, but they finally came up with that whole vast scheme, right, to take all of their different inclinations and rationalize them as all in one twofold basic philosophy of the yin and the yang, right? All your different dichotomy tendencies, they can all be seen as one, you know, great twofold overarching thing, and we can all be one people under that one twofoldness, right? See, they've got all that done. Right? It took them, you know, long time, millennia to do that. Once you have all those details in place, see, once they get themselves firmly glued together, like I said, as a social unit, okay, now let's roll.
When I try to envision a planet where the sanghic races come out one by one,
yeah.
Comes out first.
Yeah.
So they would be dominant for a long time, but they wouldn't necessarily be cohesive.
No.
And they would have such a head start
that they'd be a presence throughout the whole unfolding. So war would be every much as big a phenomenon on one of those planets as it has been on Earth.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. When every planet leads with, you know, the only wheel creatures are red men. Yeah, obviously it's going to start out, you know, quite animated, if you will, right? So no wonder a prince and his staff get there right away, right? And try to put some dampening rods into this whole boiler pot, right? Try to help them to, you know, be an example of not being so insanely nomadic, you know, and getting along, you know, and all the things that the prince's staff would try to model for them, try to temper those tendencies. You know, they obviously, the prince, the planetary headquarters makes a big impression, all right, on all those primitive people. So no matter how much they have self-destructive tendencies, right, they pull back on the reins, like, whoa, you know, fall on their knees and start worshiping and whatnot, and you kind of work from there. Right, so, you know, they obviously could take to seven commandments with a passion, right? Yeah. Instead of it just being the energy of zeal, all the prince's staff have to do is just flip it around into a religious impulse. Right? Great religious impulse. Right? Instead of directing all that zeal at ideas about your tribe and against that other tribe, why don't you have zeal for the ideal of God? Direct that zeal upward so it can be a religious impulse, right? Instead of outward as a self-destructive warring phenomenon. Yeah, you had something?
Well, I remember we just read a little while ago, hence the plan of Melchizedek to send a million of Adam and Eve's kids to Americas, where the red man was isolated. It makes me wonder what the rest of the plan was, that once they amalgamated, what would have happened, because it would have probably cooled them off a little bit, and give them the wisdom along with the zeal, and the other things to be able to make them. Could have been interesting.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you don't want to, you need to get them blended in, right? I mean, so you go over there and upstep them, but you can't let it sit there long, isolated. You've got to get the races blended together. These tendencies for yellow man to isolate and red man to isolate, like, you know, driven to isolation, but nonetheless ending up isolated, those were part of the big tasks that Adam and Eve faced. They have to not only kind of get in touch with them, start working with them, but they've got to try to haul them back in a bit and start getting them blended.
Maybe that was part two of the plan they didn't tell us.
Yeah, I mean, and so just think about the logistics, you know, of that. I mean, that's what, you know, Adam and Eve are just despairing. It's like, oh, the logistics. I mean, this is so impossible. How are we going to get them from, you know, clear over there, you know, and get this blended in some proper way? I mean, it's a very huge problem. To, you know, but I'm sure the Melchizedeks had all the basics laid out. All they had to do is follow the plan.
And Adam and Eve had more of the patience of yellow man.
Yeah, right. Yeah, think of Adam and Eve had the patience of yellow man. Exactly, yes. Yeah. Yeah, so, again, when you're, if you favor directionality, notice how that's a double-edged sword. It's like that feeds impatience. You don't have time for place? Got to go. No, you need to take some time for place, Adam. you have a serious place-like job. You got to build up a great mass of place of the violet rays, you know, before you start sending them off anywhere. Yeah, so it's counter nature to do place-like things when you're so directional.
Do we get much input about the how are these staffers comprised on a normal world where will appears in red first? Do they use that for the staffers?
We have no idea how this works normally. Yeah. It may be the case that they don't base the staff so directly on the genetics of the planet like they did here normally. Because remember here, the plan was very much to feed that genetics, you know, back into the system. You know, with the biologic offspring of the prince's staff mating with the first generation children of Adam and Eve. And so, and the fact that you have this very convenient pre-blended race, the Andonites, that you can plug them in and, you know, and have it mutate into this basically Adamic-like stock. See, it was all set up to work well. I mean, what was the genetics of Machaventa's body? Okay, he didn't have to make it so that he would, you know, he could mate with us or anything like that. Different with the prince's staff here. You know, normally the prince's staff is not being fed in genetically to the, you know, to the system, so they wouldn't have to be based upon, you know, sort of the local genetics. I would think, you know, I think that's a possibility anyway. I mean, I have no idea what all the variables are. I mean, you obviously want the staff to be able to kind of naturally think like the people on that planet. I don't know. Anyway, they don't go into the details of that, of what the normal genetic composition is for a prince's staff, any more than they explain what the deal is with the genetics of Machaventa Melchizedek.
Maybe it's enough to be from Satania.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that's the case. I mean, obviously it would be a local system conforming genetics, whether it's Machaventa or a prince's staff. Yeah, it would be definitely local system conformal. But how planetary conformal, I don't know.
This last sentence about less disturbing to the innate stability.
Mm-hmm.
Adam and Eve hadn't defaulted, they would have gotten much more than a limited infusion. So
yes, they would have
been disturbing.
Yeah. Yeah, see, and that's why I'm saying it's so important. The same time that they're juicing them up, they've got to be blending them properly, which makes it so that directionality has a holistic predicate, if you will, and it isn't so limited and part-like and flying off on some just part-like tangent, you know, that can't be purposed into the whole well. Yeah, so that's it's a very complex thing for Adam and Eve. They're just as much fostering the blending of the races to balance it out genetically as they are trying to prime the pump of the sanguine nature, you know, and I'm sure there's a whole physics to that. You know, you blend a little bit, you prime a little bit, you blend. You know, I mean, there's probably a whole physics to how you do that without it getting too biased to one, you know, mode or the other. It's like, well, you've done too much blending without enough, you know, upstepping, or you've done too much upstepping without enough blending. And you know, remember how they tell you that this cross current thing is very problematic. Right, see, so they know somehow how to blend it so that the blendings are net positive instead of net negative, with all of these unfortunate cross currents in the mortals' minds, that you're just going to put those inner tensions on steroids if you give it a biologic uplift. You know, instead of two little trickles flowing at cross purposes, it's two massive streams, you know, flowing at cross purposes inside the person and just tearing them apart. So, yeah, see, there's a whole physics to all that we obviously don't understand. Okay. Meanwhile, back to China. What do we have here?
The later waves of Andites brought with them certain of the cultural advances of Mesopotamia. This is especially true of the last waves of migration from the West. They greatly improved the economic and educational practices of the northern Chinese. And while their influence upon the religious culture of the yellow race was short-lived, their later descendants contributed much to a subsequent spiritual awakening. But the Andite traditions of the beauty of Eden and Dalmatia did influence Chinese traditions. Early Chinese legends place, quote, the land of the gods in the West.
Okay, so, yeah, so there's, you notice how they're starting to give you, you know, if you know Chinese history, you know, at great depth, you go, oh, that's what that whole kind of fuzzy land of the gods in the West stuff is about. Right, they don't appreciate how way, 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 way back you had this very tight coupling between the far East and Mesopotamia, because they don't know that there was a dynamic mobile element that could couple two remote peoples like that, the Andites, right? That's what no one, you know, everyone is in trying to understand the ancient past as if it was all Sangic, right? And very place-like, so that there wouldn't be long-term linkages like this, right? Because there is no directional people. Okay, so like I said, they're trying to give us this recognition that when we think of things, you know, getting going very dynamically in the second millennium BC from historical records, or archaeological findings, it actually goes way, way, way back. Okay. I mean, sure, it wasn't, Iron Age linkage between the East and the West, right? Okay. But it was nonetheless a significant cultural linkage. Okay.
It's been a long time since I remember them mentioning in these papers that we've been reading recently, the beauty of Eden.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. We get so caught up in the material details and stuff. You know, don't ever forget how significant a little bit of a, from the Andites, getting a little bit more of truth, beauty, and goodness, if you will. So that you don't just speak of a far distant place, but it's a beautiful far distant place, right? And you speak of, you know, the beauty of heaven, you know, or things like that, right? Those sorts of ideas are getting fed into the yellow race by the Andites.
Without that, they wouldn't probably think of it as the land of the gods.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you definitely see how, it didn't take long for the mythology that we all know about, where Adam and Eve get turned into various, divine god bearers, the land of the gods. Okay.
The Chinese people did not begin to build cities and engage in manufacture until after 10,000 BC, subsequent to the climatic changes in Turkestan and the arrival of the later Andite immigrants. The infusion of this new blood did not add so much to the civilization of the yellow man as it stimulated the further and rapid development of the latent tendencies of the superior Chinese stocks. From Honan to Shensi, the potentials of an advanced civilization were coming to fruit. Metalworking and all the arts of manufacture date from these days.
Okay, so maybe just get the geography in first. So besides Sunan, they now mention Shensi. Okay, so that's the in-between province. As you head east out of Xinjiang, and you go through Gansu, Right? Then you go through Shensi, and then you finally end up in Honan, as you go to the east. Okay? And as you can tell from what they're saying there, the between Shensi and Honan, that's where most of the core of the civilization lied. Where there's going to be an ancient capital and those sorts of things. Especially as they're saying, when you start to get this whole bit of building cities and engaging in manufacture and stuff, that you'll have a capital. Okay. And it's going to be in that region. Now, the one thing that you also notice there, until after 10,000 BC, and so if you're kind of just thinking in simple terms, like, oh, okay, so I'm getting into the Mesolithic now. I'm still 2,000 years away from the Neolithic, right, the New Stone Age. What, metalworking? Right? That's the other thing, of course. Just like we saw in other places, there's just no concept of how far back there was metalworking in all these areas long before the Bronze Age, long before 3500 BC. And so, that's, again, the Andites are doing that. But by and large, that's all. Unknown to current archaeological discovery. You obviously have problems with metal rusting away, right, over long spans of time. Stones, hang around for a long time. So you got that same issue again with the unexpected metalworking from that Andite culture. But it's... again, like they're saying, by and large, it's not, the Andites aren't coming in and usurping, sort of replacing. I mean, they're just coming and blending in, and it's just, so now there's a more animated core, foundation to these Chinese people kind of is keeping them from solidifying too much all the way down to the core, kind of keeping them fluid and slowly the potentials actualize through the evolutionary process. But the potentials can actualize because the pump has been primed by that Andite blood. If you freeze the potentials, right? They're not in kind of a liquid form. They can't reform and actualize. So that's the basics of what's going on here. And you can see they say that directly. The potentials of an advanced civilization. And again, they say advanced. See, right? They keep giving you that very kind of foreshadowing word. Not merely, say, progressive civilization, but advanced civilization. Okay. Let's see. I think I got everything there, didn't I? That's right. There's one other little element. Remember that one of the main reasons people are being shoved around like that, why you have these Andite migrations, is that whole climatic change thing. They don't miss an opportunity to remind us of just how much climatic change, or if you want to say it the way you always say it now, climate change, there's been. Right, it's the whole story. I mean, mankind wouldn't have gotten anywhere if he wasn't shoved about by the climate. Right? An indispensable cattle prod, we shouldn't imagine that we still don't need such crude means to get us moving, right? To get us to actually use our minds, Like, now we don't even need to use our minds anymore. We've standardized everything. We've dotted every I, crossed every T. You know, we can just replace ourselves with fancy machines. That's when the cattle prods come in. That's when angels build speed bumps. That's when geology, the conspiracy latent in geology, manifests itself, right? Whether you need the snowplow of a glacier to get you moving or whatever, you know. There's a vast conspiracy to keep us needing to use our minds. Yeah. So, okay. Let's get the next paragraph here, and I'll give you another little comment about Shensi.
The similarities between certain of the early Chinese and Mesopotamian methods of time reckoning, astronomy, and governmental administration were due to the commercial relationships between these two remotely situated centers. Chinese merchants traveled the overland routes through Turkestan to Mesopotamia even in the days of the Sumerians. Nor was this exchange one-sided. The valley of the Euphrates benefited considerably thereby, as did the peoples of the Gangetic Plain. But the climatic changes and the nomadic invasions of the third millennium before Christ greatly reduced the volume of trade passing over the caravan trails of Central Asia.
Okay, so, see, if you don't go very far back, it appears they've been isolated. Now, you need to go farther back when various factors like climate weren't conspiring to break what's called the overland routes through Turkestan to Mesopotamia, what we call the Silk Road, right? And where does the Silk Road begin in China? Well, it begins at the capital, right? In Shanxi province, it begins at Xi'an, or Xi'an if you want to totally Englishize it. Right, that ancient capital where the Terracotta Warriors are. Right, everyone knows the Terracotta Warriors, right? That's Xi'an. That's the beginning of the Silk Road. That's the ancient capital. That's in Shanxi province. And so, see, that you've got that set up. You have between Hunan and Shanxi, you know, that's the core of the civilization. And you very much have them reaching out to everyone else along the same path that they came into, the Andites came into China on, you know, Yellow Man, some before that too. But of course, most of the Yellow Man, remember, didn't come through the Tarim Valley. Remember, we read that, right? They came along the coast and came up from the south. But not all of them. They came in that way, and then that's the pathway back out as merchants, for instance, to keep in touch with the rest of the world until it starts getting, more and more problematic. If you have limited sophistication, if there starts to be very vast deserts you have to pass through, you know, it can really cut down on how well you can do that. Not to mention when you get, you know, these nomadic invasions of more barbaric peoples messing things up. You know, they don't want, who needs this civilized stuff like trading routes, right? They're lining themselves up so that we can rob them. Right? It's like trains in the Old West, right? If you're a train robber, you know, it's very convenient that they get themselves all collected in a nice line where you can approach it and rob them all. Notice they're bringing in the fact that you've got connections with northern India there too, the Gangetic Plain. And that continues on. I think everyone knows that, you know, an awful lot of the religion that ended up in China started in India. And because of those linkages, you know, to the Gangetic Plain, it flowed from those regions over into China. So you get all these normal routes established way, way back, and not just wealth travels along those, but religion travels along those lines. The Melchizedek missionaries traveled along those lines, for instance. Okay. All right. So that's the basic story. You know, everything was just centered there in northern China, and then slowly over time, more and more of that area, you know, came to be dominated by that nucleus in Hunan and Shanxi, until, you know, you have, you know, today, even those, you know, more Turkestan-like, if you will, Western provinces are now, right, encompassed by that, you know, that phenomenon. Okay. So now you can see we're going to keep going. They carry us way forward in China. They don't sort of like just leave us back at 2000 BC or something. So they've got a lot more to kind of give us, to help us to appreciate how that carries forward to present times. So like I said up front, that's kind of one of the main points here, is this is there's a thread flowing through this that's very important to understand now, right? It's not just a history lesson.
Section 8, Later Chinese Civilization. While the red man suffered from too much warfare, it is not altogether amiss to say that the development of statehood among the Chinese was delayed by the thoroughness of their conquest of Asia. They had a great potential of racial solidarity, but it failed properly to develop because the continuous driving stimulus of the ever-present danger of external aggression was lacking.
Okay, so they're not, it's not totally devoid of that double-edged sword. See, they're trying to remind you. I mean, there's a reason why, for instance, war is one of the indispensables to the progress of early civilization. Right? It doesn't progress without harsh cattle prods like that. So you short-circuit that, they're not going to progress. They've got this incredible solidarity because they favor the fifth adjutant. But it actually needs some poking. So you can think about how the Japanese poked them a little bit in the Second World War. Kind of got it moving again. There needs to be that ever-present danger of external aggression in those early phases of progressing civilization. You need war, but all good things taken to extreme become bad, right? Even in early times, there can be too much war. Red man was a poster child for. And, you know, peace is a wonderful progressive thing, but, okay, not ahead of its time, right? It's just a poison to progress ahead of its time, as they're saying there. Okay, all right, keep going.
With the completion of the conquest of Eastern Asia, the ancient military state gradually disintegrated. Past wars were forgotten. Of the epic struggle with the red race, there persisted only the hazy tradition of an ancient contest with the Archer peoples. The Chinese early turned to agricultural pursuits, which contributed further to their Pacific tendencies, while a population well below the land-man ratio for agriculture still further contributed to the growing peacefulness of the country.
Okay, so a bunch of things here. You're conspiring. Remember we read back there that the Chinese of 15,000 BC were aggressive militarists. Okay. And now we're rolling the ball forward, and they've just so completely taken hold of Eastern Asia that all of that military culture is just evaporating. And there's no use for it. They've figured out how to basically get along with one another, and most of the planet has no idea they're even there. Okay, and no one gets like, "Ooh, I should go over there and conquer those Chinese." I mean, it's like not even Alexander the Great. He wanted to go way over into Central Asia and India and stuff, but he wasn't burning with his passion, but it's all about conquering China. They're just like out of sight, out of mind, clear over there, right, in the Far East. Obviously, if they have much less of a tendency to be nomadic, they're going to pick up on all the teachings from the first and second epical revelations about agriculture, right? And really, that's going to settle in. It's going to, like they said, that's going to add to the their Pacific tendencies. And then the whole land-man ratio thing, the point there is, they have plenty of people. They don't need to go war with someone to get a bunch of slaves to handle the fields, right? Because that's one of the reasons why you need slave labor, is to get agriculture going. Right? When you don't have machines, it takes a lot of manual labor. And mostly that's is achieved, that transition from herder to farmer is achieved through slavery. That's why slavery is one of the indispensables. They got plenty of people. Okay, they're not killing each other. No one's killing them. Procreation is just the way procreation always is, and so the tortoise has become the hare, and they're breeding like rabbits. Okay.
Now, if I misunderstood this, that a population well below the land-man ratio for agriculture. What I understand that is, there was plenty of land.
Don't think in terms of land. Think in terms of people. All right, it's land over man, land-man ratio. Right, the reciprocal of the population density. Okay. And so you need, you've got to have a lot of people for a given amount of land. That ratio has to be low enough for agriculture to work when you don't have machinery.
Okay.
See? Yeah, right. It's a kind of a tricky one. You got to think it through, right? It's got to, that ratio has to be low enough. In other words, there has to be enough people for a given plot of land to farm it. One guy with a stick is not going to do it. you need lots of people, and if you don't have, you either have to get those people like they did by just having lots of people, or you got to bring in slaves.
Otherwise, it would have been way above the land.
Yeah, right. It'd been that ratio would have been too high for agriculture, right?
Which is a problem in some places now.
Yeah. So that's the.
But the land-man ratio, you've got that right.
Yeah.
Just the above or below part.
Now, obviously, there's a problem in the other direction. You get too many people in a place, and that leads to problems too. Okay, if you can't handle garbage and sewage and whatnot, here you're just you're just that basic thing of you need quite a few people pre-machine age to farm. Okay. Denominator increases, the ratio, denominator increases, the ratio decreases. This land-man ratio decreases. So, yeah. It's well below, right, what you need. See, it's well below, right? You got plenty enough people. Okay.
Pretty soon it's going to be land-man water ratio. Saying it contributed to their pacification.
Yeah, see, they don't have to go, you don't have to go war with other people. You bring back slaves.
Okay.
See? See, don't think internally. You got too many people in the same place and they're bumping elbows and they're wanting to kill each other. No, see, that's not the issue. They don't have to go warring to bring back slaves. Yeah. All right.
Consciousness of past achievements, somewhat diminished in the present, the conservatism of an overwhelmingly agricultural people, and a well-developed family life equaled the birth of ancestor veneration, culminating in the custom of so honoring the men of the past as to border on worship. A very similar attitude prevailed among the white races in Europe for some 500 years following the disruption of the Greco-Roman civilization.
Okay, so this whole issue that we, we sort of, just simplistically call ancestor worship, more technically it's ancestor veneration, because of course it's not genuine worship. But notice that they're saying something kind of curious, that that it's so honoring the men of the past as the border on worship. Well, what do they mean by that? That's that whole bit of, like we've spoken of many times, where you take what's in the external environment and bring it in and falsely exalt it up into the seats in the upper domain. Scientific dictation, social usage, religious dogma. Right? If you bring this in and so exalt it, right, so honoring, right, that it basically takes the place of the spiritual cosmos on the sixth level of meaning, the level of worship, right, that's what they're getting at. I mean, that's, when you go through the whole history of evolution of religion, so often they're talking about worship, but it's always, there's sort of, it's in quotes, or there's an asterisk next to it, however you want to think about it, because, seldom are they literally talking about genuine worship, that self-forgetting synchronization with deity, all, that sort of stuff. Right, it's what we've always called worship, which is reverence or veneration. Yeah, and you hear,
see, they get down on their hands and knees and pray to their grandparents.
Well, it just, they have shrines, right? For those great individuals that went before.
Oh, the good old days.
They may not literally go prostrate in front of it. But pretty close, they've got the incense burning and the whole, very sacred arrangement of special objects and pictures and, see, it's...
that was their religion at that
time. Yes, it obviously, when you put that much energy into venerating your forefathers, there's not much left for some God notion, see? That's what they're getting at. We have only so much energy in that regard, and if you kind of direct it all like that, you don't have much left to, of time or energy to think about a God notion and trying to direct some energy that, upward towards that. And it comes in with all these, like we talked about, they have this great past to remember. And it gets remembered, and so obviously that feeds into venerating the past. The whole fact that you're an agricultural people is just a much more of a conserving people, right? The stuff of the past is being carried forward, and thought about as part of the future, right? They're not burning their bridges behind them. Right, like a more nomadic people. And then we all know they have this very definitive family concept. And again, that's the fifth adjutant, right? I mean, the first social group is the family, right? So the first domain for the fifth adjutant is the socialization, you know, within the family unit. All right, so all that, see, feeds into the ancestor veneration. And when all is said and done, what's the big issue with ancestor veneration, or if you want to call it ancestor worship? Which direction do you basically have your eyes set now? To the past, not the future. You cease to be a people of the future.
Everything you do is based on...
Right, is respecting the past,
yeah.
Right, and not discovering the future. Yep. All right.
No, wait a minute.
Oh, there's something else? The bit about the Greco-Roman? Wait, what now?
Is that referring to the Dark Ages?
Yeah, right. I mean, you go into the Middle Ages, yeah. And, you know, everyone's remembering the glories of the past to the point where, you know, it becomes a fixation. And everything stops. And it isn't until we're born again, the Renaissance, right, that we sort of reawaken as a people of the future. Right. See, we got, if only it was like back in the glory days, you know, when there were roads and they were maintained and, you know, yada, yada, yada. Right. It took us quite a while to sort of find ourselves again and, you know, shake that off and direct our sights to the future again. And as soon as we did, that's the Renaissance. Yeah. See, and again, that's why it's called, you're literally dead, you know, in a sense, see, and need to be born again, Renaissance, right? What that Renaissance is referring to is a people who have set their sights to the future.
Instead of back to me.
Instead of, you know, backwards or, you know, or even merely just to, you know, living as an animal in the moment, sort of, you know. You know, you're born as a people, with a future time orientation, right? That's what that's referring to. Born again. Okay.
The belief in and worship of the one truth, as taught by Sing Langton, never entirely died out. But as time passed, the search for new and higher truth became overshadowed by a growing tendency to venerate that which was already established. Slowly, the genius of the yellow race became diverted from the pursuit of the unknown to the preservation of the known. And this is the reason for the stagnation of what had been the world's most rapidly progressing civilization.
See, now it's preservation, right?
See that today.
The orientation is to the past, yes, see? And we've talked about that so much. See, they brought that truth. I remember I mentioned how powerful an idea that was of Sing Langton's to speak of God as the one truth, right? So that you're not satisfied with any facts. Your ultimate desire is to transcend facts in a quest, seemingly impossible quest to transcend facts and try to encompass truth, right? To transcend time and take hold of eternity. It's a great, powerful concept that he put forward for them. Right. And that's what's happening today. That's why this book is in my lap. Right. We ceased the quest for truth roughly at the beginning of the 20th century. Became content in just, adding more decimal places to our information about the facts. People call themselves truth seekers, but that's because they don't know what truth is. Contentment with fact seekers. So there it is again, just reminding you that's again, you picked up on it immediately there, John. I see. Yeah, see, that's what's happening now. That's again, that's this this, the emergency, right? Where there is no truth, the people are dead. And what does Jesus say about that? I mean, so dead that you just cut it and throw it in the fire. Pretty harsh stuff he says about that. That's what's, the light has gone out. Right? The illumination has gone out in the mind. Truth is the illumination for the facts in the mind. Okay.
Between 4000 and 500 BC, the political reunification of the Yellow race was consummated. But the cultural union of the Yangtze and Yellow River centers had already been effected. This political reunification of the later tribal groups was not without conflict, but the societal opinion of war remained low. Ancestor worship, increasing dialects, and no call for military action for thousands upon thousands of years had rendered this people ultra peaceful.
Just think of that right now. No call for military action for thousands upon thousands of years. You just can't even comprehend. What does that do to a people? It's like, boy, that doesn't sound at all like Europe. Yeah, you suppose? I mean, yeah. I mean, Europe couldn't go 10 seconds without a war. It's just so different. The history of the Yellow race. You've got all these factors just setting in. Now, notice they brought us way forward. Between 4000 BC and 500 BC. So in other words, they took us all the way through the spiritual quickening event of the 6th century BC. Right? They took us through the Jews being, in exile in Babylon and everything in the 6th century B.C. and all that. Right? We're clear up to 500 B.C. now. You have philosophy, rolling in Greece. There between the lines there is that 6th century B.C. obviously would have brought in an awakening that would have put the final pieces to have this political reunification. Right, to have enough of an awakening to a bigger picture again because of that they could consummate the political reunification. And then the cultural union, though, right, had happened long before that because this fifth adjutant favoritism is going to do that. So even though, like I said before, even though the Yellow River culture was pushing way ahead of the Yangtze, right, eventually, from that central foundational location, it spread, right, and brought a wider and wider circle within that cultural context. All right, I guess we can keep going.
Despite failure to fulfill the promise of an early development of advanced statehood, the Yellow race did progressively move forward in the realization of the arts of civilization, especially in the realms of agriculture and horticulture. The hydraulic problems faced by agriculturists in Shenzi and Honan demanded group cooperation for solution. Such irrigation and soil conservation difficulties contributed in no small measure to the development of interdependence, with the consequent promotion of peace among farming groups.
So just more and more, how much this agriculture, agriculture culture, fostered their peace amongst them. We all know that you've got all these issues of big dams that they build and all that stuff. Still today, they're still working on all those sorts of issues.
I grew up had a communal irrigation ditch that we shared with our neighbors. And that was one of the things you had to do, is get together and build a dam on the river to force the water up into the irrigation ditch.
Yeah.
It wasn't always looked forward to, but it was something that had to be done.
All right. So
it was a communal
people found a way to get together for a little while anyway, and, you know, get over the Hatfields and the McCoys issues and work together so that you could water the crops.
Farmer at the head of the dish took all the money.
And then the guns came out again. But, you know, you can see, you know, they're pointing out, they get the sharing thing better, right, than the Europeans. Right? And so, you know, they wouldn't have, you know, the farmer at the head of the irrigation ditch taking all the water. Right? They over all those thousands of years, they well recognized that, no, this all works out if we all just work together. You know, everyone gets what they need, and we'll all be fine, and we don't have to be grasping. They've got, you can just see how you're just sowing all these seeds of potential. You know, in this very slow evolutionary process, it's all building to be able to do fancier things, you know, than hydrology. In a very significant group fashion. Now we know they got a big rock thrown in the pond, you know, with Mao and all that stuff, right? But, you know, they're working through that, kind of getting themselves put back together again. All right. Did we get everything there? Again, the statehood. Those are the things. You know, remember the whole civilization thing, right? You know, go from clan to tribe to nation to territorial state. Right? See, you know, not only that, but advanced statehood. Right? See, they keep saying things like this to reminding you how much potential is there. If you don't literally juice it with andite blood, give it enough exposure to a more directional andite civilization and some reminder of how that military stuff works, right? So the Japanese can kind of re-educate them and Americans can re-educate them and right, they'll get rolling again. Okay.
Soon, developments in writing, together with the establishment of schools, contributed to the dissemination of knowledge on a previously unequaled scale. But the cumbersome nature of the ideographic writing system placed a numerical limit upon the learned classes, despite the early appearance of printing. And above all else, the process of social standardization and religio-philosophic dogmatization continued apace. The religious development of ancestor veneration became further complicated by a flood of superstitions involving nature worship. But lingering vestiges of a real concept of God remained preserved in the imperial worship of Shangti.
Okay, so again, they're kind of just enumerating all the various issues that were making progress for them just sort of inescapably very slow. Right? They don't have an alphabet. They didn't get the teaching about the alphabets from the revelators, and so they're stuck with this very complicated system. We all know, how just the run-of-the-mill, simple individual couldn't wrap their mind around such a complicated system of symbols. And even though, as we all know, they were leading the way with printing, relative to the West, but you've got these very problematic things that were, that we know led to the fall of Rome. Right, and are besetting us again, this social standardization, and the whole religio-philosophic dogmatization. Like I said, everything just He's like, oh, we've got it all figured out. It's, you know, we can just replace all of us with fancy machines now that can follow the recipe. And we get more and more set with that. We start to hate anyone, you know, upsetting, you know, the cozy system that we've got all set up. You know, that's just not the way we do it. There's a standard practice to such things. You know, you hear, start hearing this more and more and more. See, and that's a dying people that say things like that. All right. Yeah, and then we all know that, you know, when you start to get into the current, you know, religious context there, there's an awful lot of very primitive, you know, nature worship stuff. That, see, again, if you stop progressing, you know, material gravity starts to kind of drag you back to the roots of, you know, and so nature worship stuff starts to get really blended in there. There's lots of really, you know, kind of grotesque, superstitious stuff that, you know, shadows haunting, you know, the minds of the religionists. You know, it loses that gleaming white of truth, right? It starts to become the dark shadows of grottos again. But, right, there's, you've got, on the positive side, because they haven't burned all their bridges behind them, you know, to a fault, because they do think so much about the past. They are still hanging on to a thread from Sing Langton. Okay, and you know, when you jump up in the Melchizedek teachings in the Orient, you know, they talk about Shangdi, that name or God concept. You know, it I'm trying to think. Yeah, it's getting kind of late. I better not read too much. I'll just kind of summarize it. But it's up there. If people are interested, you want to look on your own. It's let's see what paper is that. That's paper 94, section 5, is the struggle for truth in China. And you know, they talk about Shangdi. That concept is coming from Sing Langton. You know, where it's like we talked before. You basically are going to have some heaven concept, you know, so it's the God of heaven, basically, to begin with, and they point out it kind of later, you know, it comes to be known as the spirit of heaven, yeah, because obviously it's gonna start to lose kind of a very definitive personal concept with time when you don't have that reinforced. But nonetheless, you know, you have this on high concept of a God that's coming through, and you know, to some degree. And then the Melchizedek missionaries get in there and reinforce that a little bit. You know, if they're already kind of thinking upward, you know, God of heaven, spirit of heaven, right, that's just right there for Most High, right? And they're thinking up, the word, you know, the concept of Most High is just follow your finger, right, upward. And so, you know, you can just, yeah, that's the Most High God. Right? And so Shangdi, which is what it, you know, kind of literally means, Shang, Most High, the God, you know, kind of literally means Most High God. And that's in the wake of the Melchizedek missionaries, speaking of God as the Most High, reinforcing that the vestige is coming down from Sing Langton, you know, where he was pointing them, you know, away from the nature stuff, you know, horizontally, and pointing them upward to heaven, you know, giving them an upward concept about God.
What do they mean by imperial worship?
Oh, again, it's, you know, the cream of the crop, holding on to that. You know, it's like in, you know, I say even in Rome, right? The you know, the better peoples are worshiping in more sophisticated ways than the common people. Plus, you know, bringing, you know, purposely saying it imperial worship, you feed that in to you know, the concept of emperors there, of, you know, again, kind of hearkening all the way back to Mesopotamian concepts when the gods came down from heaven, you know, to earth. You know, the emperors, you know, or the, you know, the political leaders start to pick up on that, you know, and I'm that God of heaven here on earth made flesh, right? You know, just the way, you know, the divine right of a king, you know, that sort of a concept. But in the Far East, there, having it tied to the Shangdi concept, and the God word there, if you will, the DTI, you know, being kind of used as emperor, you know, word for emperor. Okay. So that's between the lines of that. That's sort of just, you know, what you can recognize. But the immediacy is just what I'm saying. I mean, it's, you know, the more sophisticated people are, you know, are not all, you know, into gobbledygook of, you know, basically nature worship, right? They're still holding on to the, you know, the essence of Sing Langton's teachings. Okay. Okay, I guess we got all that. I'm going to keep going here.
The great weakness of ancestor veneration is that it promotes a backward-looking philosophy. However wise it may be to glean wisdom from the past, it is folly to regard the past as the exclusive source of truth. Truth is relative and expanding. It lives always in the present, achieving new expression in each generation of men, even in each human life.
When it goes into the past, it dies, you know, as it were. So you know, we already basically spoke to that when they brought up truth a little bit ago. Right, that's the big deal, right? Is that everyone is looking backward, and you know, there are people of the past instead of a people of the future. They have a past time orientation instead of a future time orientation.
Consequently, the Second Amendment stays in.
yeah, obviously, right, you wisdom has its place, the reflection on the past has its place. It's just there has to be all three, not just wisdom, but wisdom, insight, and foresight, past, present, and future. And they're losing the insight and the foresight. You know, and just, you know, basically memorizing, you know, so-called wisdom carved in stones, all right? You know, and even wisdom, you know, basically dies when all it is just, you know, words on a stone, all right? I mean, wisdom's of no use unless it's living within you in relationship to truth. Yeah, truth is the key. When a people lose their relationship to transcendent truth, they're a dying people. They're sort of just they're living on fumes and on grace, you know, of your initial encirclement in the Holy Spirit. And, but that only lasts for so long if spiritual evolution continues to amp up free will. I mean, eventually humans have enough personal nature, spiritual nature, that they can negate all of the gifts of grace, and then you've got an emergency.
They didn't have a spirit of truth. Didn't have a spirit of truth.
Right.
Which, talking about truth, is significant.
Think about how, see, again, that just speaks to when they talk about, oh boy, what the Chinese could have achieved. Right? If they had that full focus on truth, when you get the spirit of truth poured out, I mean, you might have had a people where the spirit of truth isn't sitting there twiddling its thumbs, like it is, you know, for most of the planet. Like, well, okay, I have the spirit of truth, but, yeah, is it able to do much of anything? Yeah, you know, like they say in paper 34, spirit of truth really can't do much of anything until you take delight in cultivating, making a place for it to function, you know, by growing your relationship to the Holy Spirit. Right? You get a little bit of Holy Spirit by grace. You get none of the spirit of truth by grace. Right? The spirit, you know, the first measure of the spirit of truth is predicated on a measure of the Holy Spirit beyond what you have by grace. Right? So, like I said, as the spirit of truth, yeah, you know, certainly, you know, in any conscious way, okay, super consciously, yeah, there's some benefit, but consciously, so that it manifests in civilization, you know, in a significant way. No, I mean, this, you have the spirit of unification, so that you can get an adjuster as a seventh circler, and that's about it. Right now, it's just twiddling its thumbs, waiting for you to, right, to be grown into something that it can work with. Yeah. All right. So. You know, and truth can't be defined as words, you know, right? And what's the rest of that? Only by living, right? See, it lives, you know, lives is italicized there. It lives always in the present. Again, you know, words are dead. Truth is living. All right.
The great strength in a veneration of ancestry is the value that such an attitude places upon the family. The amazing stability and persistence of Chinese culture is a consequence of the paramount position accorded the family. For civilization is directly dependent on the effective functioning of the family. And in China, the family attained a social importance, even a religious significance, approached by few other peoples.
Oh, right, again, we, you know, that the family is the nucleus of civilization in so many ways, as we've studied. You know, and again, you can think about how much these things got disrupted by Mao and the Cultural Revolution and whatnot. But right, they're working through that. And you know, they
specifically, how did Mao change that? I mean, because you don't have one child type thing, or
right? You know, you just this whole thing? I mean, when you say, okay, all you are is just interchangeable gray parts, okay? Hey, I see he's taking you back to the horde. Pre-family, right? That's why it's so corrosive. You know, you literally, you know, it's like everyone wears an identical gray suit, right? Because you're just a vast sea of interchangeable parts. There isn't such thing as family. There's, you know, there's nothing. It's just you're a horde.
yeah. They literally broke up family units.
Yes.
You have to go over here.
Yes.
You have to go over here.
Yeah. Right. You just, you know, erased all that. So, you know, it was very, very destructive. But it's, you know, once you get that out of, you know, once they get that out of their system completely, we know what the history is. They have so much tradition there, it can come back into place in short order. And they can be a mighty force again. Okay, keep going.
The filial devotion and family loyalty exacted by the growing cult of ancestor worship ensured the building up of superior family relationships and of enduring family groups, all of which facilitated the following factors in the preservation of civilization. 1, conservation of property and wealth. 2, pooling of the experience of more than one generation. 3, efficient education of children in the arts and sciences of the past. 4, development of a strong sense of duty, the enhancement of morality, and the augmentation of ethical sensitivity.
And so if the family falls apart, so do those four things. Right? And we saw that before. You know, we've gone through these lists of what civilization needs in order to be enduring. I mean, you have to have all these elements. How important property and wealth is, and all these things. Again, all of the factors that in one way or another are disrupting families now. Maybe it's just, I don't get the whole family thing. I mean, I've got to be me, or whatever it is, whatever, we know we got, just hundreds of different notions in our heads now, or influences that are disrupting the integrity of the family. So that's the nucleus of civilization, so civilization will collapse. There's going to be no preservation of civilization, like they're saying, if you don't have conservation of property and wealth, for instance, et cetera. Including, remember how on the neighboring planet, the island continent, what things were taught in the family? Notice number 4 there. Right, the enhancement of morality, the augmentation of ethical sensitivity, those things that they knew are so fundamentally of the family and not of the collective, certainly not of the government. There are many things that only the family can do, and the more you have collectivist mentalities that are basically Maoist, right, that have infiltrated into the United States. And there's a lot of very devout Maoist people in the United States. Right? It doesn't matter how many people Chairman Mao killed or whatever. I mean, they still hold up Chairman Mao as a great example that we should all, orbit about. They lead to a corrosion. Those sorts of voices lead to a corrosion of all these key elements, civilization. All right.
The formative period of Chinese civilization, opening with the coming of the Andites, continues on down to the great ethical, moral, and semi-religious awakening of the 6th century before Christ. And Chinese tradition preserves the hazy record of the evolutionary past, the transition from mother to father family, the establishment of agriculture, the development of architecture, the initiation of industry. All these are successively narrated. And this story presents, with greater accuracy than any other similar account, the picture of the magnificent ascent of a superior people from the levels of barbarism. During this time, they pass from a primitive agricultural society to a higher social organization, embracing cities, manufacture, metalworking, commercial exchange, government, writing, mathematics, art, science, and printing.
So you notice how much they're doing what we've just been doing. I mean, they're hearkening us back to all that stuff that we went through about civilization. All those papers on civilization and using the Chinese example here to reinforce those. To remind us that we must choose these things. We can't be so confused philosophically that we stop choosing these things, because naturally we're barbarians. We're not civilized. Civilization's unnatural. Civilization's a choice. Right? And they're just stressing that again. You don't want to live in a barbaric United States.
That would be pre-savage.
Right? It's just, it's not what you want. Even something, and we don't have to talk about all these things, but just to remind you of some of the stuff we talked about back there. Yes, there are abuses in industry, okay? But you can't, totally demonize industry because of that, right? That's that foolishness of the ancient skeptics. Falsehood exists, therefore truth doesn't exist. A greedy industry exists, therefore industry is innately greedy. No. Okay. The industry in Havona is quite enlightened. All those things, it's so easy to, to put blinders on and just get fixated on some little black dot, and believe it to be the entire, universal reality. That's when we lose that big picture and we start running with the falsehood of some, circumscribed viewpoint like that, that's when it all is going to unravel.
What's the point of that surprising willingness
point? Yes, you show a surprising willingness, right? The more you fixate on some little narrow thing, you can rationalize anything. So, you eventually rationalize it, as a panacea, issue. I mean, that it just, it's the cause of every problem. It undoubtedly has some validity, has some place, some of those issues. But if you think it's the solution to problems that it's not, the cause of, that'll make the situation worse, not better. And that's the whole point of that. You should show a surprising willingness paragraph.
It's like when they talk about the black against the white backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
You don't look at spots of white peering against a whole black
background.
So what happens today because of communication
every black dot goes viral now.
Yeah, right. Everybody wants to hear about the black dots.
Yeah, right.
They don't want to hear about the white dots.
And again, why is the natural tendency, right, to focus on the black dots? Right? Why don't we rationalize, fixate on white dots? Again, like I said, your initial spiritual consciousness is used in a negative mode as an error and evil detector. Right? So, you don't notice the white dots, right, with that child of God spiritual consciousness. You notice black dots with it. Yep.
Don't animals have a tendency to be fear-driven? And
sure.
So if we're not raising ourselves above that by being objective and, choosing to not be like that, then we're more fear-driven and black dots would be more fear.
Yeah, see, that's the whole story of the history of the evolution of religion, right? See, obviously religion begins with some rudimentary spiritual consciousness. And so what happens? You notice black dots, or you imagine black dots, right? And you develop a whole religion of fear, right? Your animal fear, when you show the animal the black dot, right? The animal responds fearfully to this ominous black dot that the human has shown the animal, right? Right? And it all becomes predicated on fear, right? The whole religious scheme. Yeah. Yeah, and that's what they're pointing out with, you know, with them bringing in all of this, like I said, you know, the fear of the dark shadows and the walls of the grotto, you know, and all that just dark nature worshipy stuff that gets in there, right? See, it becomes more and more fear-based. And, you know, if you don't keep your human self looking towards the light of truth, right, the animal dominates and its fear dominates.
It seems like the only way around that is the upliftment of consciousness.
Yeah.
You know, which is talked about in many world religions, but you know, it was a big thing in the 70s. It seems to have faded out. I don't know what it is.
Again, see, I mean, if you, you know, it's just a matter of you have. It's not natural to look up. Right, it's natural to right. My eyeballs, right, if you think of it in literal eyeball terms, my eyeballs look horizontally, right, not vertically, right. You know, in that analogy, you know, just you naturally, you know, look horizontally, and instead of your religious effort being genuine and being focused up to the spiritual, it's focused horizontally to the social. Right, and the religion becomes more and more about horizontal social issues. Instead of vertical, spiritual ones. Right? And it's just we've come, you know, back around to this over and over again. That's the whole problem. It's natural you know, here it is right here. They mentioned 6th century BC. What do the Hebrews have naturally prior to, you know, the awakening in the 6th century BC? What they call religion is horizontal. It's about social justice, right? And then they coincidentally get shoved into exile and exposed to a little bit of Andite, you know, consciousness. You know, no matter how much it's gotten muddled up in, you know, Babylon by that time, but still, you know, in relative terms, it's an enlightenment. You know, and you combine that with just the, you know, awakening in minds in the 6th century BC, and they come out of that with the beginnings of genuine religion, a focus on the spiritual instead of the social. Right? But, you know, over time, the head naturally drifts down, because, you know, your neck gets sore if you hold your head up for too long, and, ah, that's much more comfortable if I just look, you know, and so eventually, you know, most of the Jews, you know, they just are worried about social justice again. And everyone else on the planet is becoming more and more just, you know, it's all about social justice again. It's not that social justice doesn't need to be considered, but it's not religion. All right.
And so the ancient civilization of the yellow race has persisted down through the centuries. It is almost 40,000 years since the first important advances were made in Chinese culture. And though there have been many retrogressions, the civilization of the Sons of Han comes the nearest of all to presenting an unbroken picture of continual progression right on down to the times of the 20th century. The mechanical and religious developments of the white races have been of a high order, but they have never excelled the Chinese in family loyalty, group ethics, or personal morality.
Right, you've got the fourth adjutant, favoritism of blue man, right, but right, you know, you don't have the natural associativity that the yellow man has. And there you have the Sons of Han. Right, I mean, those core Chinese people, right? Right, they're now, you know, called the Han people, or the Han Chinese, or just the Han, or right, or as the relatives say to remind us of our relationship to the Universal Father, right? The Sons of Han. Right, the Sons of Han is what we're fundamentally talking about. Okay, that's the largest ethnic group on the planet. Right, that mass we've been talking about, that's the Sons of Han.
Who's Han?
And I was just going to explain how those people came to be called the Sons of Han is the Han Dynasty, you know, in basically Roman times, is kind of the big to-do times, You know, same way the Europeans are hearkening back to the glory days of the Roman Empire. Okay, they, you know, they hearken back immediately to the Han dynasty. Okay, and they began to speak of themselves as, you know, the Han people, or, you know, or the rebels would say the sons of Han. And that the Han people, if you will, then, like I said, they're the largest ethnic group on the planet. I mean, there's about 1.3 billion sons of Han, right? In a very pure sense, right? All right, that's 18% of the population of the planet is the sons of Han. Okay. All right, so see, like I said, they're finishing this paper. They're bringing you to that, you know, that recognition. That's what you've got, right? Fifth of the mass of mankind is the sons of Han. Okay, that's a mass to be reckoned with.
And again, we say how unfortunate it was that somebody like Peter and Paul China.
Yes, but you know, they've learned other things from the West.
Well, this is a cautionary tale because they've developed their civilization largely independent of ours. I mean, they're not, their civilization is not been dependent on the West.
No.
And they're not going to take something that we want to give them without comparing it to the wrong. And when they see ours not being that shiny, they're not going to embrace it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, not only just kind of that, you know, in sort of present dynamics, but yeah, just thinking about what we just read, where does fundamentally the civilization, you know, come from, where it always comes from the Andites? I mean, sure, they're primary Sangiks, and they have all this potential, like they've explained everything. Okay, but yeah, right. I mean, it's the Andites. I mean, are the Chinese going to be oh so open to being told that, you know, who really got things going there in Honan province? It's those what you would think of as white people, right? You know, they aren't literally white race; they're Andites. No, they're not. You know, they're going to resent that. Right? This isn't going to be good news to them. I'm so glad you told me that, and of course, you know, there's more and more, like you were just saying, there's more and more of a reaction. You're saying that philosophy is really a Greek fact. Well, I reject that. It's a Chinese fact. Greek philosophy is false philosophy. Chinese philosophy is true philosophy. And when you start to build up, the more they kind of open themselves up to the world, the more you build up those reactionary antagonisms and dichotomies like that, where they reject truth despite their face, you know, as it were. You know, I mean, they, you know, that's not me, so I'm against it by principle. So yeah, you have all those things beginning to, you know, to play. And like you were just stressing, when all is said and done, it's like, okay, we don't need anyone. You know, we did great things without anyone. You know, so they believe, right? We didn't get help from Mesopotamia or anything like that, right? You know, they believe they did it all by themselves, and we're going to do it again. They'll try to not notice it, you know. Most of what they've got, they've stolen from other people. You know, they won't think about that. But right. Yeah, but see, again, they will purposely blind themselves to that because they have such a desire to be this independent civilization like they believe they fundamentally are. Right. So they'll delight in self-trickery like that. Yeah.
Painfully ironic. Veneration isn't directed to the past that gave them the means to do that.
Mm-hmm.
they don't know it yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what happens when they find out? Maybe they'll be more alert.
Yeah. Well, over.
How it gets to them.
Yeah, you know, you could see that there might be a problem with lack of humility as this mask gets animated. And so you could see how the revelation could inject some humility into this mass, because it's going to need it.
Yeah.
1/5 of the population being very self-righteous is a big problem. Okay. Okay.
This ancient culture has contributed much to human happiness. Millions of human beings have lived and died, blessed by its achievements. For centuries, this great civilization has rested upon the laurels of the past. But it is even now reawakening to envision anew the transcendent goals of mortal existence, once again to take up the unremitting struggle for never-ending progress. Presented by an Archangel of Nebadon.
Well, they give him a very positive thing, and it kind of, you know, in the light of that, the poetry kind of it, it's all sounds wonderful. But then you pause, like, oh, wait a minute. Once again, to take up the unremitting struggle for never-ending progress. Well, that doesn't sound ominous at all. all right. Like I said, that's, you know, that's the point. You see, they actually end with that statement. That's the bottom line of the paper. This is a force to be reckoned with, right? They're even now, see, as they're saying, and even more so now, since this was written, right, awakening, reawakening, as they say. See, that's saying it's not an awakening, it's a reawakening. As I say, they have it all there. All they have to do is just reanimate it. It's kind of just been sitting there dormant. They don't have to, you know, start with nothing, right? You just have to take a hold of the past something and direct it towards the future again, you know. And they want to be what defines the future of the planet.
There's effort, struggle, conflict. Mm-hmm. They're not likely to turn this conflict internally.
No.
No. But there has to. There will be conflict, or there can't be any progress.
Yeah, yeah. See, and so if we can, uplift the conflict doesn't have to be physical conflict in the effort struggle conflict. Right, we need to get a hold of this and move it up. Right, right. There are philosophic struggles that that need to occur, and the ensuing conflicts, but. We need to keep it uplifted. There needs to be some spiritual gravity in play, so that this doesn't happen down on the material plane.
Well, they may get some religious leaders. It's hard to say.
Right.
One would think.
Yeah, one way or another, right? I mean, we kind of know what has to happen. We don't know exactly how it's going to play out, but you sort of have the physics of it now. Like you're saying, you know they need some sort of religious renucleation, process, renucleation process. But what it's going to be, how it's going to come about, is it going to happen in some natural sort of a way, or is there going to be, Machaventa or, some other sun or help with this? I mean, who knows what the process is going to be, but you see what's needed one way or another. They need certain things, and they're going to do certain things, no matter what, like they're saying, but even now, right? So this is not going to go away. It's just going to keep rolling forward. And on the path of right now, they're going to build more islands. They're going to build more, ships. They're going to, right? I mean, they're about to do major war games, practicing nuclear bombing with the Russians. Right? I mean, this is all moving forward. They're all figuring out how they can take out all of our satellites, right? So to blind our military. All these things are in play right now, right? And we have to, Don't be fearful about it. We have to deal with it. We need to get along. You know, we need to develop a dynamic but understanding relationship with them, right? Because they need to respect us. Right? They, you know, they need to include us in the future as much as we're going to include them. Right? They've been kind of on a track where they're all, you know, the only people of the future is them. The sons of Han are just going to continue to spread until they're the only ethnic group on the planet, right? You know, and they need, no, that's not appropriate. You can't think that way. You got to share, right? So that's where we're headed. All right. Well, we're going to shift gears, you know, significantly next time and go to the Occident, go in the other direction, go to the West. And what about all those silly blue men and the back mating and whatnot and all the Andites that go into Europe? We're going to get into that whole story. Okay, let's take a moment, everyone.